God's plan for work, it's design and it's limits. So he's got rest in there too. It's not like just we're only made to work. We're made to work and worship and rest, and having a family and raising a family is part of the work, and sometimes it's part of the worship, and sometimes, I hope, it's part of the rest. It's dignity, because we're made in God's image. Our task, the cultural mandate to cultivate, using filling the earth and subduing it, to be a service, which is really an act of love in the world. Anything that we do that's serving the world is a way of loving the world. Being God's arms and legs of loving the world. Excuse me. I might have to stop from time to time to clear my throat. Sorry about that. Then part two talks about the problems, and it's sort of some interesting categories. You know, how work is often fruitless. Like, without God, it would all fall apart. It's basically the world is on this path of self-destruction, and without God intervening, it will all fall apart. So there's some huge fruitlessness that we see on a daily basis, our pointlessness. Ecclesiastes is filled with the meaninglessness of our work. And even more than that, how we are often the problem. I mean, sometimes it's out there, but sometimes it's the very sin inside us that is the problem with our work. It's our idolatries. It's things so deep in us that we worship other than God that we're, without work, we wouldn't even be aware of them. Work helps be the crucible for helping bring that out so that God can refine us and make us more into the person that he wants us to be. So that's part two. Part three, I would say, is an unfinished part. We did our best to pull together some basic ideas of redemption, some pointing to redemption. But I really think there is so much more discussion that we need to have in that area. We know that God gives us a new compass for our work, that we're pleasing the audience of him, not the audience of the people around us. So right away, that's a really helpful thing, that new compass. We also know that it's a new power. And I think this is a really interesting thing to explore. What exactly is the power of the gospel? What exactly is the power of the Holy Spirit? I think some of that power is in this idea of sacrificing, of dying to ourselves, so that then God can work through us. It's some of the power is modeled on the cross. The power is that sacrifice even of our whole life in order for God's purposes to be done. And a word for that is passion. I know business people use the word passion all the time. We want to hire passionate employees. When you go in for a job interview, you muster up passion like the best cheerleader in town. Passion is a word we throw around really, really loosely. The passion of an entrepreneur. You would never invest in an entrepreneur if they weren't passionate about the new venture that they're starting. But the root of that word is the passion of Christ. The root of the word passion is being willing to sacrifice everything for this higher good or this greater good. So when we think about, you know, what kind of power do we have, it's in a passion to be able to want to serve God in a way that is that gives us a motivation and a heart and a power and an energy beyond what we would do for anything else in the world, because we want to serve God. We're willing to sacrifice more. So how do we understand God giving us that power, or how do we use that power that he's given us? So I'm actually going to break right now, and I'm going to give you an exercise. We're going to spend 5 minutes by yourself, so you need to be able to write something down. I hope you all have your conference book and a pen. And then we're going to share with a person next to us. So if you have an odd number of people on your row, you can share with two other people next to you. We'll spend 5 minutes alone, 5 minutes sharing, and then I'll pull some of your answers to the front to close up the exercise. But here are your questions. And this is for you to think through specifically in the work that you are doing right now. I don't mean right this moment, but the work that you are doing when you're at your work. So this can be work that you're doing that you get paid for. This can be work that you're doing if you're looking for a job. This can be work that you're doing that you don't get paid for because right now you're doing work that you don't get paid for. But whatever that work is, I want you to think of it in terms of creation, fall, and redemption. So creation, what is God's purpose? What's God's grand purpose for the work you're doing right now? Two, fall, what is broken about your work right now, both the forces outside of you and the idols inside you? And three, how might the gospel change or redeem your experience of work? So I'm going to say it again. Creation, fall, redemption. What is God's purpose for the work you're doing right now, his creation purpose? Fall, what is broken about your work right now? And three, redemption, how might the gospel be able to change your experience of work? Got it? I'm going to time you for 5 minutes.
Joking.
Yes. No, that wasn't.
Oh, that wasn't you. Okay.
No.
She
no.
was She's again, another blonde person and very kind also. Oh. Yes.
I'm definitely blonde.
One more minute. Okay, now I'm going to ask you to take 5 minutes and share with the person next to you for the purpose of really triggering new ideas. Sometimes someone else sharing what they've thought of will help you think of things that you hadn't remembered when you were just sitting to write. So this isn't meant to be a complete exercise. Hopefully this will be something that you continue to think about over time. So if you don't know the person, say hello, say your name and where you work, but you've got 5 minutes to share, two of you or three if you need to, with the person next to you. Thank you very much. No, I just have this bad throat, so hoping a little tea will help me. Thank you. That's wonderful. Thank you.
You're welcome.
You still have some people trying to squeeze in?
Yes.
I think there's a few seats back here. It's a full room.
It is.
So much. That's really great.
This is good. An extra tea bag.
I won't need it. Thanks. This is good.
You want a cup to put that in? Or?
I can just stick it here.
Okay.
I can give this to you, actually. Thank you. If you, I don't know if you have a garbage can, but
I'll find one.
Thanks. Make sure the other person has had a chance to talk. To stop you, but I'm going to anyway. It's actually more fun to talk to each other than anything else, but I'm going to stop you anyway. I apologize. I would like to have some people share. Is there anyone whose work is in the arts that can share? I have a hand. Let's go.
I didn't think I would immediately.
That's all right. You were good. You were quick. I like it. So stand up and see if you can sort of be heard by as many people as possible.
My name is Shelly. I'm from Hamilton, Ontario, and I am a wedding and lifestyle photographer. I see my work as glorifying God by imaging his creativity. He is an artist, and I am an artist. I see it as a way of bringing praise to him by showing people the beauty and the creativity that is in your average everyday life. When I do take pictures of chaotic family life. and then I also see my job as a way of serving people as God commands us to remember his goodness in our lives, and I capture those moments so that when they go through difficult times, they have those good memories to remember and to see them through, like God commands the Israelites to erect stones.
That's wonderful. Thank you so much. That's great. And a lot of times the church is not that kind to artists in terms of seeing, we're so utilitarian and, you know, how have you exactly served the poor? And a lot of artists, we have a large Redeemer in New York is about 20% artists, and they say that they feel very lonely in their churches. So one of our goals here is to make all vocations honored by God. He needs all of us and out of in every sphere of culture. Do we have anybody here who's an educator? Would you be willing to share?
Yes. Okay. God's purpose for my work.
Give us your name first.
Sorry. I'm Megan. I am a high school math teacher.
That's great.
So the purpose for my work is educating people about how God's earth that he created works. What's broken about my work, I think it's interesting when I talk to parents and parent-teacher conferences, learned a lot about how people see education as their savior. They see their kids, they want them to have a better life, they want more money, they want more degrees, and that sort of thing, thinking that if we can educate people, we'll have better politics, we'll have a better government, that will be our savior.
You point to God through your actions. There's a theologian named Al Walters. He's up at Calvin College, and he talks a lot about the structure and the direction of our profession. Like, the structure of education's wonderful, but when we turn it into an idol by saying it's the savior, the direction starts to get really off target. So that was really helpful that you could share that. How about somebody in business? The sort of ugly, no one loves it. All right, right over here. Good, thank you.
I'm in sales.
Sales, all right, that's even more dramatic. Okay.
Oh, my name's Missy. God's purpose in my work is to continually remember his goodness, that he is good. What is broken about my work is it is very easy when you're in the business world for your employer to, your value goes up and down depending on how you deliver their according to their expectations. And that is a very unstable way to view your identity. And so it's so easy for your job performance to become an idol. And so that's one thing that God is really, really teaching me, is that God's approval of me is not based on anything but the finished work of Christ on the cross. And that is secure. I am his beloved daughter. And so when I have my little protocols, it's okay, you know? I'm going to be okay. And I can trust that he's going to provide for me, even if I get laid off, you know? And so it takes away a lot of my fear. And so that's what I would say the gospel changes, is that I am secure in Christ. And really, I really work to the glory of God. It's an opportunity to serve people. But if I fail in my job, it's okay. And that's just given me so much freedom and peace. So much peace. That just that makes me want to tell my coworkers, you know? Don't worry. Rest in Jesus.
which your sales manager would hate. I worked with a colleague once. He ran the sales department in this telecom company, and he only hired people that were in debt. He said, people who are really badly in debt are so hungry to make a sale. They will really work hard. I was like, oh my gosh, this is so sick. So many sales managers would not want you just to work for the glory of God. They wouldn't understand why that's far more motivating than anything else we have to work for. Anybody else want to share? Yes, come on, stand up so that we can hear you in the back.
My name is Elizabeth, and I'm a hairstylist. And what I love about the creativeness of it is that God has given me the longevity to be with these clients for a really, really long time. And to get into their lives and have them into my home, I do it one day outside the home and 2 days inside the home. But what is broken about that job is that so much value is put on the way we look. And so much value is what Hollywood says that it's supposed to look like, and especially for these young girls, of what they're supposed to look like. And it is so consuming and absorbing for our young people and for us. So the redemptive part of it is to show them that they're beautiful. And I hate the word homely, or if someone says, I teach my kids all the time, that they're not homely. God made them and they're beautiful. So just to show them that they're beautiful and that it doesn't have to be wrapped up, that God looks inside the heart, not at the outside, and that he sees what's going on in here, and that's what's most important. And that we can be beautiful at all ages and all, you know, steps of the way. So,
yeah, I mean, beauty is a God-given thing. It's this wonderful thing, and we've poisoned it with one standard of beauty. And all of us who are on the decline of our beauty are really concerned about this, what's going to be happening in the next stage. So, yes, we need some good redemption in that area. Anybody else? We have time for one more. Yes, thank you.
Psychosomatic issues with those students. The problem with my job is the brokenness and the pain. they look at me like I've got four heads, but I'm planting a seed. Because most of these boys do not have dads. I'm from Alaska, and so I'm from the inner city school in Alaska, which doesn't sound like an oxymoron, but it's true. I also need to teach them about how their bodies are different than they need. And that is so fun.
Thank you very much. Thank you for you brave people who shared. And I think we'd love to just hear all the stories of everybody in this room. I think it's actually a way that we can minister is just to ask people their stories, especially young people. You know, what is it that God is, even in the job you hate right now, what are God's purposes for this particular job? And how can we help them think in that bigger picture of God's purposes for our work? So one of the frameworks that I'm wanting to share is that creation, fall, redemption framework. The second one has more to do with how does the gospel work in changing things. So Bethany Jenkins, who works for the Gospel Coalition, has started this faith and work ministry that she's calling Every Square Inch. And that comes from Abraham Kuyper, a Dutch theologian in around the 1900s. He was theologian and became prime minister. So he sort of had this view of the Bible and how to live it out in the world. And his very, very famous quote is, "In the total expanse of human life, there is not a single square inch of which Christ, who alone is sovereign, does not declare mine." In other words, every industry, every job, every workplace, every company, Christ is saying, it is mine. I want the gospel to redeem that. So we work at Redeemer with this framework of how does the gospel change, sort of in expanding circles, our heart, so our own self person. How does it change our relationships with other people? And then how does it change the world in which we work? So sometimes that's the actual institution that we work in, or even the vocation that we work in. And some of us even have an impact on the culture at large, or some aspect of society at large, like I think that incident at Seattle Pacific had last week. So the basic dynamic of how the gospel works is the same in each of those expanding spheres. As a matter of fact, it changes your heart, and then you go out and you have a little bit of a redeemed relationship, and then you have an unredeemed relationship, and you have to go back to your heart and let the gospel change your heart. So it's this sort of iterative process. You get out into the world, and life's circumstances point to yet something else in your heart that needs to be changed. So you're back and forth from your heart to your relationships to the world. And how does it work? It works through a process of... Well, I'm going to give you an example. Sorry, I jumped ahead. I'm going to start with a personal example with my heart. I'll give you some of my own story. So I was a Christian midway in my career. I was already a leader in this high-tech world. I knew I was supposed to be somewhat different after I became a Christian, but I was clueless as to what that would look like. Should I be nicer, more upright? I mean, I was already sort of nice, and I didn't cheat on my expense reports. It had to be more than that. Now, in God's mercy, at that point in time, he had not shown me the full depth of my sin, or I would have understood exactly how much gospel difference needed to be made. But he used work to show me my sin over the years. And certain themes just carry through. I care so much how I look in the eyes of other people, far more than I care how I look to God. I care lots more about what I get from work than what I give to my work. Some, you know, really core areas of sin have been themes throughout my life. After 10 years of becoming a Christian, that became crystal clear for me. I had shut down the internet company that I was running, and I was looking for my next career move. When Redeemer approached me, at this point I'm living in California. I'd moved to California for work. And they said, would you be willing to move back to New York and help us start a marketplace ministry? And I thought that was the stupidest, craziest, most interesting, desirable idea in the whole world. My reaction was, you've got to be kidding. I'm going to give up my nice home to move back to New York City. I'm going to give up my status as a high-tech CEO. I'm going to give up my income, my dreams of a beach house, the weather. It was all give up. I'm going to give up. There's no way I'm going to give up, give up, give up. That's all that was going through my head. Which was all the more awful because for the last 10 years, I'd been talking about what a calling I had to business. And I wouldn't have been there if God hadn't called me there. And it was like suddenly I was just a big liar to my own self, that when I was called to something else that didn't have quite the same level of perks, I was suddenly not very interested in this calling thing. It was really the point when I realized my only objections were my identity and my idolatry. I had no other possible objections to doing this except those things. How do I do that? You know, I can say, all right, I'm going to take this job, but my heart never changes. I thought, these idols are deep in my heart. So if I'm going to take this job, I also have to count on the gospel actually really changing me. Otherwise, I'm just putting on another mask, looking for another set of idols that will somehow maybe compensate for the last set of idols. So how does he change our hearts? And it's really when I started to really try to dig into this. And I think it's in this whole idea of dying so that God can make you reborn so that you can give God glory. It's a death, resurrection, glory kind of cycle that the gospel works in. So I had to really die to those idols. I had to be willing to put them on the altar, to put them on the cross. And for me, there always seems to be, when I give up those idols, this Easter Saturday. Like, you know, Christ dies on Friday, and then the disciples, they don't know Easter's coming. I mean, we do. Easter Saturday's not that bad for us. For the disciples, they're just sitting there in that extraordinary letdown, that extraordinary disappointment, not knowing that there was something else that was going to happen the next day that changed everything. And I think a lot of my times of dying to my idols, to my sin, has been a sitting in an Easter Saturday of just going, all right, Lord, in faith, I gave that up, but this is not feeling good at all right now. I have no idea when you're going to show up. And I think sometimes for my own faith's sake, he doesn't show up right away. He gives me that time that I just have to go deeper in. Do I have faith in you? Do I trust you? But it is that death. And then eventually God comes through and he shows you how present he is in your life. And you get that little glimpse of resurrection. You get that little tiny glimpse that it's better to be with him than to be serving your idols. And that gets you enough to go on to the next step in order to then be able to give him some glory. So that's sort of at the heart level. Then we take it to our relationship level, and it's pretty similar. I was single through all of my career until I was 58 years old, and God gave me a husband out of a total miracle. That's another talk and another story, and I'm still sort of stunned. But those of you who are married know that I am being refined in a whole new way in the relationship side. You know, when I lived alone, I was always right. It was great. It was just great. And I'm still always right, but my husband doesn't agree. Fortunately, he's strong enough to not give in to that. But it's a very similar thing. I'm having to die to myself for that relationship to survive. It's a death, resurrection, glory cycle. It's a little easier to understand in relationships. We think of that in a marriage context, but it's very interesting at the church level. We started vocation groups for, at one point, 18 different vocations, and I said, you know, we'll start this vocation group if you can get four people to come and sign on as the leaders, and then we'll I'll work with you to start this group. Well, four people leading is challenging. It's sort of easy to lead one leader of this group and another leader of that group, but four people, they didn't tend to have the same vision for the group, or they didn't tend to have the same style of leadership, or they didn't tend to have the same liking of each other, or the same idea of how the gospel should be at play in this particular group. And I was really working to, you know, how do we work through this process? Do I just say, well, let's just only have one leader, or do we plow through this? And I finally said, you know, this is a laboratory. This is the laboratory we need for God to show us how he is at work redeeming relationships in this sort of greenhouse, this incubator, where it's actually all agreed that we all are serving the same God. So that when we go out into the world, we've got some practice doing it. We know what it's like to die to ourselves so that the relationship can thrive. We know what it's like to experience redemption and then glory inside our relationships. That's been a really hard thing to get across. I don't know how other church leaders do this, but we've got so many opportunities right inside our own church context to be practicing what we need to be doing out in the world. One of the things that I did as a corporate leader was I took over a company that was rather flawed. It was severely damaged. And so I had a lineup of managers coming into my office complaining about another manager. And at some point I thought, you know, I think I need to use Matthew 18 here, because we were just all so siloed. The entire culture was, how do I tattle on this guy, and I'm going to spend all my time complaining about what the other guy's not doing. So we never were getting anywhere. And I finally said, well, you know, to every single person who came to me, go back and talk to the person that you have an issue with, and if you two can't resolve it together, then both of you come in and I'll talk with you about it. And it was amazing. I mean, I don't really think anyone went back and talked to someone, but they stopped coming to me, and miraculously, teamwork started. It was like I cut off the channel of complaint, and we started to see teamwork happen, and the culture of the company changed. I mean, a very simple thing of seeing the gospel at work. They didn't know it was the gospel, but it was the gospel at work. It was the truth at work, setting them free from some really bad behavior patterns that had been allowed in the company prior to that. So it works even in our secular culture. How does it work in the world? About 20% of Redeemer work in the arts. The other 20%, another 20% work in the financial services industry. And I give that exercise to every single vocation group on, you know, what are God's purposes for your work? But I have to tell you that this very large financial services industry group was stumped with the question of what are God's purposes for your work? I mean, I'm a sales and trader. I don't know what his purposes are for my work. I'm a hedge fund manager. I don't know what his purposes are for my work. It was like the stumper question. I thought I was going to lose all of them with that question until 2008, when the entire financial services industry collapsed. Lehman Brothers goes out of business, and everyone else was just in a lineup for that until we had a government bailout. And even more than that, it was damaging the whole world. So suddenly this person who had a little job in a little tiny piece of the financial services firm that couldn't see where it made a difference was seeing that what he was doing was a part of this thing that affected the entire world, the health and the survivability and the sustainability of the entire world. And they came back after that crash saying, all right, we're gonna figure this out. What is the purpose of the financial services industry in our world, and how can we be part? It's now died. I mean, for about a year and a half, it was dead. There was nothing happening. People were getting laid off. It was just sort of holding on by its fingertips. And they all spent about 6 months writing objectives for what they could do in their particular role to be an agent of redemption in some way in their firm or in their industry. And it was a pretty beautiful, remarkable thing to see. they were able to hold out some hope that God would be at work through them in their work. So I think a similar process happens in the world. Often it's a death of something in the world, not just as clear as Seattle Pacific when it's an actual shooting, but even like the financial services industry when it falls apart, or when a company dies and falls apart. There's a chance for God to work then to rebuild something that's better or healthier. And I think we need to look at things in our world that are falling apart and saying, all right, things will fall apart. That's not the end of the story here. When they fall apart, we're the people that go in with a new hope and a fresh promise to try to bring redemption and God's light into that situation. So we have this pattern of death, resurrection, and glory as we go from our hearts to our relationships out into the world in which we work. We have no assurances that the world's going to get better and better and better. That's not what the Bible says. Until Jesus comes again, that's an enlightenment thinking. That's not biblical. In the Bible, it's like it falls apart, God comes back and renews his covenant with us. It falls apart and he comes back. It's just this cycle of it falls apart and God pulls us up again. So it's not the better and better story, but it is a redemptive story. It's a constant renewing. And God lets us be part of that. And I think we have to develop eyes to see the glimpses of him at work. And it's not always just through us. He works through people who don't know him. He works through people that are just in a place, a position that he's put them in, a leader in our country. He works through common grace. He works with people who don't know him. So we have to get eyes. One of the hardest things for people in theater, for example, is the Christian world will say, oh, there's a Christian in that play. It must be a good play. As opposed to thinking like another non-Christian can be an actor and really reveal truth through the quality and skill that God's given him as an actor, even if he doesn't know Jesus. So we have to get eyes that are very discerning to be able to understand where God's redemptive work is going, and we have to be able to talk about it. I don't think we will ever get agreement. We will never get everyone in this room to say, so the way God is going to redeem education is X. We're going to always have people who want to homeschool and people who want to send their kids to Christian schools and people who want to send their kids to public schools. We need to be able to give grace and respect. We need to talk about that civilly. So how is God at work at world? What glimpses of him at work are we seeing? So I think that's really the third part of our book. We just didn't feel like we had enough data to develop it as fully as we want. I hope that someone will be the person God, maybe even in this room, the person God calls to write that next stage. But we need to develop a language and a way to talk with each other about how he's working in the world for his redemptive purposes. And I think I'm going to open it up to questions on that note. So I hope you have some questions. So I'll keep. Yes. Yes, I did not identify them. They volunteered. And all I had to do was try to keep them from splitting because, you know, the lawyers would come and say we want a lawyers group, and then the corporate lawyers and the social service lawyers would say, well, I'm not going to be in a group with them. They're not Christian. So they would want two groups, and I'd have to say, no, really, we're going to have one group for lawyers. Or we had the educators group that had the Christian school educator that hated the public school educator and vice versa. So I really felt like for a while, I was going to have a whole bunch of groups of one, and I tried to pull it together. But beyond that, I just was looking for people who are interested in leading a group in their area. So it shifted a lot. Sometimes we had marketing and advertising together. Other times advertising and design would be together. It was more based on the interest of the leaders. I think a church, I mean, we're a big church, so we could have had 100 groups. I think almost any church could have an arts group, maybe you call it business group that has advertising and lots of other things in it, and maybe a social services group that would cover education and all healthcare, all the kinds of things that are the more serving professions. I will say that the serving professions sometimes have a harder time thinking deeper about how the gospel is at changing or affecting their work because they check the box off on their serving and they don't think anymore. They just go, all right, done. I'm a good person. I'm serving. I'm a doctor. I'm serving. And it's hard for them to get beyond that and say, well, how is healthcare broken? And how does healthcare need to be redeemed? And how can I be an agent of that redemption of the industry, not just the work that I'm doing on a daily basis? So there's sort of some interesting dynamics depending on which of those three categories you're talking about. I also think you could have family be an area of work. We don't. I wish we did. But I think that, you know, to just view the work as paid work is not really that healthy theologically. So if we could also have a group that looked at how do we work as a parent, what's the work part of that, the job part of that being a parent, or how am I working in my civic community as a wife or a mother, I think that would be, or a husband and a father, how would that be, how can we think about theology of work in that context? Or even parenting or caring for your, yeah, I mean, we have such a breakdown in the family that the work of caring for family, older and younger, is a huge need in our world. So good thought. Anyone else? Yes.
You brought up the financial services industry and how it's dumped the people. I'm married to someone who is very much in that industry, and I'm wondering, what can I do as a wife to encourage dying to self and making a sacrifice instead of having work be an idol and not even realizing, you know, because...
Yeah, so the question for those in the back is, if you're married to someone in an industry like financial services and that spouse does not necessarily see the brokenness or see the idolatry that's going on, which... You know, I don't really know how we change our spouses because I'm really new at this. I'm sure you guys could teach me a lot. No, I think God only changes our spouses. But I do think the conversation, the more you can have the conversation. Pastors say to me, well, I really can't relate to people in the marketplace because, you know, I don't understand their work. And I'm like, well, do you work? I mean, we all have idols in our work. Moms have idols about what a good mom they are and whether they're a better mom than some other mom across the street. We all have sin in the way we approach our work. So the more the conversations can cross spheres, I think the easier that will be. And I do think that sometimes people just aren't ready for this conversation. I've got tons of people in the church that I'll work with them a lot, and they will say, well, everything that we're doing in our company glorifies God. We have this honor code. And I'm like, wow, really, there's nothing in all those thousands of people in your company that's broken. And it's just they're not at a place to look at, God is not prompting them to look at the brokenness. And I think then you pray. Because I think it's really helpful. I mean, you don't want to wallow in brokenness. We are people of promise. We've got to move from the brokenness to the promise. But you can't go straight from creation to the hope. You've got to look at what's broken before you really value the grace that we've been given and the hope that we've been given.
So I work with students. So a lot of what we're dealing with is... like you mentioned passion earlier, but they all seem to be interpreting passion as I can't have a job unless it's my passion, to the point where they don't choose anything. They just
right.
keep.
So for those of you who couldn't hear, she works with students, and they're looking for the job that they're passionate about, but they don't really have one that they're passionate about, so they don't do anything. It becomes immobilizing. And I think there's a real myth in our culture. I think even churches do this thing that if you just get your perfect set of gifts together with the perfect opportunity, you will serve God in this perfect way. And most of the people I work with have so many options. They could do so many different things. They just really need to do something. And God will work out his path for their life one way or another. So I think we're selling some myths out there that are not theologically based. So how do you get past that? Sometimes asking people to go back and write in what ways did they really feel like God used them awakens a little bit of that sense. But, I think it's the word acedia, the sloth that, at our heart, we sort of run from God. Moses did. I mean, we sort of say, I don't really want to. When they're looking for the job they're passionate about, they're not really looking for it. They don't really want to put their life on the line and work like a dog. They want something they really love but don't have to work too hard. I mean, that doesn't really work that way. So it's looking through and trying to, in a way, it's trying to deepen a caring. And how do you get, that's one of the values of mission trips, I think, is it gets young people to actually realize they care for the pain that they're seeing in this other part of the world or whatever it might be. I mean, we really have to develop a caring about the problems of the world as a church. I think that's part of our role. Because, I love the book Lean In. I don't know how many of you have read it. I am so glad that after my early years of being sort of the fruit of feminism, that somebody's talking about equity in the workplace at some point. And she brings up all kinds of good statistics about the brokenness in the world. But everything she talks about is for your sake, your career. It's you should be pursuing equality in your career for your own sake. And it's like, wow, that just, you wonder why women are dropping out of the workforce. It's because that's not really that motivating. In the end, we want to care about something that really matters. Matters to God, not just for our own sake. It's a small percentage of people out there working that are doing it solely to glorify themselves and be at the top of the hill all by themselves. So unearthing that, what are things that are worth caring about in the world? And it's tied with where do you feel like you can make a difference in that? And that starts with the small things. I think one of the interesting things, some people speculate that this current generation of 20-somethings is more socially conscious than the decades before. And a lot of them tie that to 9/11. That they experienced in their high school or college years, this huge death, this huge drama that caused them to care more deeply about some of the issues in the world, and they want to fix the problems. But we haven't trained them very well for caring, so I get a lot of them that, basically if they're not with Bono in Africa, it's not good enough. The stage isn't big enough for them. And, caring about the neighbor next door is just like a little bit too small for me. And so we've really got to train what it means to step by step let God use us, and God will give us a bigger path if we and something a bigger world to serve in if we're faithful with the one that he does give us, and that's part of a training that we need to be part of. Thank you. Great questions. Anybody else? And I'm close to breaking. Yes. Yeah, I think there's a huge brokenness in our workplace that technology has aided. There's no boundaries. There's not a 9-to-5. I was really disdainful of 9-to-5. Only boring people have a 9-to-5 job that they leave. Those of us who are really, really professionals work night and day and, 24/7 and all that. That's sick. And yet when you're not in a very influential position inside your organization, it's really hard to challenge that. And sometimes you just have to go through the mill. You have to pay your dues in order to be able to have a little bit more freedom to challenge that. And then the goal then is to just not let your heart buy into it. So kind of like boot camp, if you've gone through boot camp hazing, you make it tougher on the next person, you can buy into it. What you've got to do is if you make it through, you've got to actually try to change it when you're on the other side and have some influence. So how can we do that? We're in a culture of, you know, constant push for more productivity. It's harder and harder. And God is so clear. You know, God says, don't harvest the entire field. Leave the edges of it for poor people to come along behind you. In other words, take home less yourself so that others can have some. Don't work on the Sabbath. Even though your neighbor might work on the Sabbath, I don't want you to work on the Sabbath. Don't worry, I'll take care of you. There's some part of this that is just trusting God and saying, I've got to put some boundaries up around my time and trust that God will provide for me. I may get fired from this job because I can't make a dent there, but maybe it'll be a little bit like Nehemiah going to the king. Maybe when I put down a boundary, I'll be blessed for it. And that's a discernment issue. But I think we need to all own that it will eat us alive if we don't have boundaries. And we just need to be able to create boundaries. And it's not just to serve your church. It's to serve your community. The civic culture of our society has fallen apart because we're working so much. Nobody's being a volunteer fireman anymore. I mean, our culture across the board is suffering because we don't have any spare time to serve our community. We don't even have time to say hello to our neighbors. So it's a problem as a society that if we can own the problem, then we look for glimpses that God gives us of ways to push against it. All right, that's our last question then. Thank you very much, very much, very much.